Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. India is a country that is undergoing rapid modernization. The result, for some people, has been great wealth, but many others have fallen farther and farther behind. Our guest for this hour, journalist Siddhartha Deb, tells this story by introducing us to five people, five Indians, among them a very wealthy businessman, a farmer, a factory worker, a waitress, and trying to use them and their lives to tell the story of globalization and what it's meant for this place where he was born. This morning in this part of the show, we will be talking about his book, The Beautiful and the Damned. The subtitle is A Portrait of the New India. Faber and Faber is the publisher. Our guest, Siddhartha Deb, teaches creative writing at the New School in New York City. He's also the author of two novels. His reviews and journalism have appeared in many places: Boston Globe, Guardian, Harper's Magazine, The Nation, The New Statesman. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. We just hope people can be brief, just so we can get as many people in as possible. But questions, comments are welcome. If you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And you may also send email if you'd like to pass along your questions, comments that way. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Any point here, questions are welcome. And Siddhartha Deb, hello.
Hello, David.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate
it. Thank you for inviting me.
Just to begin, I want to ask you about the title, which you have borrowed from F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Absolutely.
From a novel that he wrote that was set in New York City in the 20s, in the 1920s. And I'm interested in whether you see perhaps some parallels between the roaring 20s in New York and in the United States and life in India today.
Yes, it was very much a starting metaphor for me when I began researching this book, The Gilded Age, The Jazz Age, the sort of, I was interested in sort of the sort of incredible flamboyance about the new rich that people were talking about, the new rich in India. But I was also very, very interested in the incredible contrast, you know, between the new rich and the, you know, what would we call them, the old poor, the new poor, the sort of vast masses, and a kind of disconnect between this sort of, you know, monsoon wedding-ish kind of, you know, flamboyance in the cities among the rich and the state of hundreds of millions of people sort of below the radar. So Fitzgerald was very much a kind of a guiding spirit for my book, which is not to say that India is the, you know, an exact replication. It's not. It's the 21st century, not the 20th. But it was a starting metaphor. And I guess I was interested in getting into the inner lives of the rich and, you know, the mysterious sort of mobility. And obviously, it's not just the title of the book, but even the first chapter of the book is called, you know, The Gatsby. And it's very, very influenced by Scott Fitzgerald's novel, mm-hmm. The Great Gatsby.
Well, it certainly is very striking, as you've said, that we have here, as a result of this very fast movement in this country, that we have a certain number of individuals, and they get a lot of attention,
yes.
the new rich,
yes.
People like Arindam Chaudhry, and this man that you talk about here in the first chapter, and we'll talk some more about him.
Yes.
And certainly there has been growth in the Indian middle class, but it does indeed seem that the poor
yes.
Have gotten nothing like that kind of rise. And in fact, one might ask the question, are there some ways in which they are worse off than they were before?
I mean, absolutely. Let me just sort of bring in, you know, quote an expert, actually, two economists, mm-hmm. Amartya Sen, who's a Nobel laureate, professor at Harvard University, and his partner, Jean Drees, who is an economist in India. Jean Drees is Belgian in his origin, but he's an Indian citizen. He's been working there for a good two decades. And, you know, there's a recent essay that they published in an Indian magazine, and they talk about how, you know, during the last 20 years or so, if you compare India with one of its neighbors, one of its poorer neighbors, which is Bangladesh, and if you look at the last 20 years, in India, you know, the per capita income growth has been much higher than that in Bangladesh. But during the same period, Bangladesh has overtaken India in terms of basic social indicators, among which they rate life expectancy, child survival, fertility rates, immunization rates, and some schooling indicators. So that is fascinating. And that's a good kind of statistical sort of response by two very, very serious, committed economists to, you know, the what's happening to the poor. And there are many, many, many other figures available as well to show that. And the answer seems to be that either the poor are doing as badly as they were doing before, or they're doing worse, you know. But in either case, they're not doing better.
This book apparently has its roots in an assignment that you took from The Guardian, the British paper, back in 2004, and they asked you to go and write about call centers. And so you decided that really the way to do that would be to embed yourself and to go and get a job in a call center. Something I know you have talked about and have written about, and how to be able to do that, that you had to yourself go through a kind of a personal transformation.
Yes. I mean, in a way, of course, you know, it's funny. I think I've been undergoing a kind of personal transformation for a long time. I mean, here am I writing a book in a language and talking in a language that is not my first language, you know, and I don't come from a particularly privileged background, but I was very lucky to have good schooling and, you know, to have my family sort of support me. So personal transformation is a big part of, you know, my journey. Not only did I grow up in India, I grew up in the small town that is on the northeastern border, you know, far from even Indian cities. So I had to go from there to Calcutta, which is the first big city, and then from there to Delhi, which was like the capital, and then from Delhi to New York. And so when I went back to do this story for The Guardian and the call center, I had to remake myself. Part of it was that there was a lot of criticism from both Britain and, to a lesser extent, America about the jobs being lost to people in India and other countries setting up call centers. And I think the call center, the companies, some of which were owned by American corporations and some of which were indigenous, were very sensitive to this question. I think the other criticism that was being made that was more from India is that these jobs are somehow demeaning because, you know, people need to take on fake names, fake Western identities, fake accents. So basically what happened was, because of all this, the call center companies weren't really, they were limiting the access. You know, the journalists were sort of led around by PR people and shown, look how happy our workers are. And so The Guardian thought that, you know, I should try and become a call center worker and do a kind of inside story. And one of the things that comes in is, you know, that I'm an Indian, I speak some of the languages. And so, yes, I became this sort of alternate persona. I took a job at a couple of call centers. The one that I did the longest was serving these British customers. And, you know, in a way, these jobs were providing some opportunities to these young people, I think, you know, and I was sympathetic to their aspirations, to their mobility. But I was sympathetic up to the point, just because they were taking on, you know, the facts remain that the hours were also incredibly long. There was a kind of exploitation. There wasn't much freedom. And these jobs didn't seem very long-term. They seemed to have no long-term horizon. And one of the things I learned just by hanging out with these people is that people sort of, you know, would do call center work for a few years and burn out, because it was just the hours were, you know, they were mostly working late at night. We were working till 4 or 5 in the morning to keep in sync with U.S. time. It was a young person's job, basically, and you did it for a while, and the money was not bad, and then you just burnt out, and you went and did something that had to have daylight hours. People, when they got married, found it hard. People, when they had children, they found it hard to have these jobs because they wanted to be home with their children at night. So it wasn't a, you know, so it was a complicated phenomenon. And I think there's this, also this Western, somewhat Western perception sometimes in the media, sometimes it's, and it's also promoted by the urban Indian media, that if people speak English and if they have degrees and if they're working jobs like call centers, that means they're very modern. Well, in some ways they are, but in some ways they're also, I mean, what does it mean to be modern? But, you know, in some ways they're also full of prejudices against minorities. So it's a mixed bag. And that's what I found, you know, that, you know, it wasn't this sort of beautiful, rosy picture, but it was a very complex picture, basically, with some good things about it and some very bad things about it.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour focused is Siddhartha Deb. He teaches creative writing at the New School in New York City. He has written fiction and journalism. His new book is indeed a work of journalism. The title is The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. And Faber and Faber is the publisher. Questions, comments, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Also, we have email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, what you have done in the book is, because India is such a big place and the story is so big, you have tried to personalize it by identifying a few individuals that hopefully will say something about people from different regions and from people who from different socioeconomic levels. And you begin with this man that I mentioned, Arindam Chowdhury, one of the new rich in India, definitely in the mode that many people will recognize, I think, the self-made man, or at least it certainly seems to be that way. I'm the kind of person that also often we read about in Western popular media when we read about India. So of all of the people that you could have picked to fill this niche in the story, why him?
Well, he was interesting to me. He was interesting to me because, I mean, you know, and this is where Scott Fitzgerald comes in. I was, you know, I'd been told, like a lot of people, that, you know, India has changed drastically in the last 20 years. A lot of people who wouldn't have made money before have suddenly made a lot of money. And I said, okay, so let's find somebody and let's write about that. But let's let that be interesting. So, you know, I spent a lot of time in Delhi, where I began sort of working on the book, talking to both my, you know, journalist colleagues, both Indians but also foreign correspondents. And, you know, I would ask them to suggest possible rich people to write about. And one of the things is that the rich don't like too much scrutiny in India. And journalism has I began working as a journalist in India in 1994. And from 94 to 98, I was pretty much a full-time journalist in Calcutta first and then in Delhi. But, you know, as the corporatization of India happened, journalism became much more driven by advertising by its corporate owners. And it became very, very uneasy about antagonizing the rich or the powerful. And that's a change that's happened in the last 20 years. I mean, there are still very good individual journalists, but the publications do not often bear out how good they are. But anyway, so I spent some time talking about people, about finding rich people to write about. And a lot of the rich people sounded very boring because, you know, I would ask my friends, say, tell me what makes this person interesting. And they would say, well, you know, he owns, you know, a stable of racehorses, or, you know, he has private planes, which is not uninteresting, but, you know, it's not enough. And then I mentioned Arindam Chowdhury, and he said, you know, he's really a kind of portrait of India, because if you're outside, you would have never heard of him if you're in the West. But if in India, you'll see him everywhere. And once they'd mentioned him, I began to see his, you know, he's basically a management guru who runs a chain of business schools. He's also a producer of Bollywood movies. He has a media empire with magazines. And yes, as soon as somebody pointed it out, I began to see his face everywhere. And the face was very much a kind of new India. He wears a ponytail. He wears sort of a glossy sort of designer glasses and sort of designer suits, very flamboyant. You can see how it was attractive to somebody being guided by the ghost of Scott Fitzgerald. And he was a controversial figure because the question was, there was a lot of question about his money and that his business schools weren't recognized by the Indian government or the main body of the Indian government is the UGC, the University Grounds Commission. They didn't recognize it as a university. So there was a lot of controversy. People had attacked him in blogs. They had, you know, his students had, you know, in turn attacked bloggers. And I thought this is very much, there's a picture of turmoil, ambition, flamboyance, controversy. It was very attractive to me as a writer. And then I spent a lot of time interviewing him, talking to him. And I found him very energetic and intelligent and a representative in that sense of the new wealth. But then after the, you know, a magazine in India excerpted a part of the chapter, his company took out a sort of injunction against my publishing the chapter in India from a very small court far from Delhi, thousands of miles from Delhi. And so the Indian edition, when it came out, is the only edition in the world which doesn't have that chapter called The Great Gatsby, yeah. A Rich Man in India.
That's really interesting, and one reason for which the book, Beautiful and the Damned, has actually gotten some attention, I think,
yes.
Because people have said, hey, look, here's this book about contemporary India, and if you buy the edition that you can buy here in the United States, the book is complete. But the only place in the world where it's not complete and this first section has been omitted because Mr. Chaudhry didn't like it,
that's
is
right.
India.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the ironies is that, you know, the chapter isn't a hatchet job. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we'll see what the courts have to say if the court, the case, when the case comes to courts in India. You know, I have my notes. I have, you know, I mean, I'm very scrupulous about and honest about, you know, researching it. And I don't think it's a hatchet job. It's not a negative picture. It's actually, in my understanding, quite a nuanced picture, sympathetic, quite, you know, I mean, I have quite a bit of empathy for, you know, his energy and his flamboyance and his intelligence. I still do, actually. I mean, I don't have any hard feelings. And yes, there are parts when I'm critical about the larger vision. I question some other things that, you know, his company talks about. You know, there's a part where he talks about, you know, oh, my father has dreams for, you know, doing something for the downtrodden in Africa. I mean, you know, the narrator, I come into the book and I think, my God, I mean, there is something quite, you know, there's something quite megalomaniacal about these ideas, you know. And so it's a nuanced portrait, but whether it's nuanced or not, it's not there in the book. Mm. And so in India, it's become a bizarre thing. I mean, in the first place, I think a lot of people have been drawn to the book because of the controversy. But the Indian edition sort of comes without the chapter. And what's been happening is that a lot of people in India pass around the chapter on the internet. I mean, this has nothing to do with me or my publishers, because we would not, you know, we would be, you know, violating court orders if we passed it around. In India, we don't. But a lot of people, simply, it's become a kind of samizdat sort of chapter passed on the internet. People download it, and some, you know, people put it up on mirror sites, and the sites get taken down, and then it gets cropped up in some other site. Somebody even pasted the entire chapter, which is really long, it's like 12,000 words, as a comment on an Indian magazine, you know, story about this controversy. Somebody just pasted that entire 12,000-word chapter as a comment, which is very amusing and interesting and disturbing too.
Yeah.
That, you know, you people are doing this on the internet, but it's not available in the hard copy form the actual public sphere.
One wonders what really Mr. Chaudhry thinks about this. You know, the old joke about how say anything you want about me as long as you spell my name right. Whether in fact that he in some way he might think that this rather adds to the largeness of his image rather than detracting from it.
Well, I would think it does. In fact, you know, when I began when I first met him and his PR person said, you know, we will need to see all the notes and we'll need to see the book before you write, right before it goes to press. And I said, you know, I just can't do that. And they said, why not? I said, you know, think about it. I will put in all these years, and after 4 years, you will suddenly say, you know, you want this change, you want that change. It would just, you might not like the chapter. Then what do I do? You know, all this work just goes down the drain. The other thing is, you know, people, I know this because I have been both not only a journalist, but I'm also interviewed by people as a writer. It's a very natural tendency to want to correct, to want to adjust your self-image, you know, especially when you're in a big business. So they talked about it, and they said, you know, well, we can't agree to it. And I said, well, that's fine then. I am going to say, you know, take your leave. I mean, you know, if you don't agree to it, that's totally fine. And then they thought about it, and they said, well, tell us a reason why we should agree to this thing. You know, you're going to interview. We don't know what you're going to write. And I said, look, you're business people. You are very, very good at making rational sort of, you know, decisions on the basis of profit and loss. You know, the danger for you is that, you know, what I write might not be flattering, but the advantage in here is that, you know, you will get a lot of publicity if I write about it, and you have to decide what you want more, you know, whether your desire for publicity is greater than your fear about negative publicity. And I'm not going to tell you what you should, you know, you decide, you guys talk to each other. And they talked to each other, and they came back, and they said, okay, we will give you full access. And so, yes, I mean, it may not be, I don't know if it's him and the ultimately, because it's not just an individual, it's also a company. There are a lot of people's jobs, especially people in the close inner circle. There's a lot of money tied into it. And it may be also a kind of less about me and more a kind of warning to other people not to pursue unflattering portraits, because they've sued pretty much everybody who's written anything mildly critical about them.
Just one, another thing about him, I think in some ways he comes across, for all his success, he comes across as being a little uneasy and almost like the salesman who down deep doesn't quite believe his own pitch.
Lovely.
And I wonder whether, in fact, you think that that strikes you too, but whether also underneath all the boom and the excitement,
yes,
India is rather like that.
Yes, the Indian elite, the rich people, the middle classes, they are very much like that. Below, at the level of, you know, what I would call the majority, and, you know, if you go down the class ladder, or if you move away from the big cities, if you go into the rural areas or small towns, people are quite open and questioning. And at that level, people have a spirit of generosity, of tolerance. It's a wonderfully plural place. You know, it's a wonderfully diverse place. People are very different from each other. But people know a little bit about, you know, other communities. Or sometimes they know a lot about other communities. But at the level of the middle class and the rich, there is a great deal of insecurity. Because what this is basically about is that they have bought onto this story that things were really bad till the 90s for them. That's not entirely true. And that things have suddenly become wonderful in the last 15, 20 years. And, you know, at a material level, I think the middle class are doing well, although that's beginning to become a bit problematic in the last couple of years already. To the middle class, there's a kind of shrillness which shows up in a kind of intolerance about, say, minorities, a kind of hyper-nationalism. People are very, very insecure about their Indianness, which they try to make up by becoming ultra-religious in these sort of bizarre ways. And they're very, very shrill if you raise the question of inequality, because there's nothing there. You know, you can't doubt that. It's there. It's evident. It's in your face. The statistics bear it out. But there is a lot of insecurity, and the insecurity is partly a kind of sense of being cut off from their own past. Because if it means, you know, if it's really true that till the 90s we were a basket case, what does that say about your parents, about your, you know, your predecessors, about even yourself? It means, you know, you were nothing, and then suddenly in the last 20 years you've become something. And that to that, now there's an added worry, which has started basically, you know, with the global financial crisis of 2008. I mean, just think of the headlines we're talking about today. Think about what's happening in New York today, the unemployment here, the deep sadness in people, the Occupy movements all over, the financial crisis. I think there's a sense that the party is coming to an end, and these big questions about inequality, about the environment, that's the other thing that the rich, the elite, the middle class do not wish to talk about. There's this idea that building new airports, new dams, new shopping malls, new parking lots is what it means to be modern, not to preserve your rivers, your mountains, your diversity, your agriculture. And I think these big questions are going to come back, and the shrillness is about that, basically.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Siddhartha Deb. His new book is The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. It's published by Faber & Faber. Siddhartha Deb teaches creative writing at the New School in New York. He's authored two novels. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask you about the covers of the book, the one that we have here, the one that I have, and the one that I know that's on the UK version, and the one, at least the one that you would get in the UK. And I know that this is something that publishers make their choices about, but I think that they're both really interesting and they're both very different. In view of the subtitle of the book, I would say that they're both portraits in the sense that they both look like they're snapshots. The one that we have here is A very interesting and unusual combination of images where we have a guy who looks like a teenage guy who looks like maybe he's posing for a girlfriend and he's having his picture taken, and he's displaying some kind of teenage attitude, and he's got his jacket slung over his shoulders, and he's kind of looking like, okay, I'm pretty cool, take my picture. But he's standing
in, like we've all been there.
Exactly. Oh, absolutely. And he's standing in front, though, of a what looks like an outdoor, much lit Western style Christmas display of Santa in his sleigh with his reindeers and their trees with lights. And so he's standing in front of this thing having his picture taken, which is this very odd sort of juxtaposition of images. Maybe I'll just take you to, maybe you could say something about, you know, what you think when you see that picture.
Well, it's a hilarious picture. It's so touching in a way, the young man's attitude. I mean, as I said, you know, it kind of reminds me of the leather jacket sort of, you know, slung over his shoulders. I feel like I have been there as a teenager, you know. Now, the photograph was taken by a friend of mine, actually, Rafael Kroll Zaidi, who is an editor at Harper's Magazine and is a photographer and a writer as well. And Rafael, in fact, was in Delhi taking possible pictures for the cover. And I was in Delhi at the same time, so we talked about it. So it's taken in a shopping mall, an outdoor shopping mall, and I think I was in Calcutta when Rafael took this particular picture. But basically, you know, it's basically about, you know, the Santa is about, you know, Christmas. But it's Christmas as kind of consumerism. Now, let me... I'm not a kind of sort of nationalist chauvinist, actually. Christianity has pretty deep roots in India, very old roots in India, as does Islam, as does, you know, Hinduism and Buddhism. And I actually grew up in the northeastern part of the country where many people are Christians. So I have grown up as a child, I grew up with Christmas. And that Christmas wasn't a festival about consumerism. It was more about sharing. It was more about community. One of my most wonderful memories, and I'm not a Christian, and I'm not even religious, and my family wasn't Christian, but, you know, we would have these carol singers going from home to home. And it was part of the joy of growing up that you celebrated all these festivals, you know, whether the festivals were, you know, everybody celebrated everybody else's festivals. This is something else. This is about a backdrop. It's about, I think, the Santa is about, it's about mimicking a very particular kind of Western modernity. It's a Western modernity that is understood primarily through consumerism. And that's why malls, people go, people feel modern to be shopping. And they're buying these brands that are, you know, recognizable global or Western brands. And it's basically, in a way, it's a model for the model for of Western modernity. It's almost like a Dubai version of Western modernity. I mean, often a lot of the Indians, the middle class, the elite, when they talk about what India should be like, then you see advertisements for this all over. They say India should be like Singapore or like Dubai. Neither of which are exactly democratic states, you know, it might be worth pointing out, you know. But it's about this sort of controlled consumerism and this controlled environment. So it's partly about that. And in a way, again, I am sympathetic to the particular young man who's posing. I mean, he feels great. He looks like a movie star. He seems quite handsome, too, actually. You know, of course, it's a very subjective judgment. He looks great. But that in itself is just a part of India. And I think the new India, it's about promoting that at the cost of, you know, trying to hide everything else. And hiding not just the dark things, not just the poverty, but also the richness of other traditions, the richness of you know, India has always had a critique of materialism. If you think about the great thinkers, the great modern thinkers we've had, and I think primarily of Gandhi and Tagore, they were great critics of, you know, materialism and this kind of, you know, just a kind of self-indulgence. They thought India could do better than that.
Yeah. We're talking in this hour of Focus with Siddhartha Deb, and we're talking about what you will find in his new book, The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. I have a caller we'll get to in just a moment. First, though, we need to take a short break. This is Focus.
Programs on WILL are made possible by the Illinois Professional Science Master's programs on the Urbana-Champaign campus, offering graduate degrees that combine science and business, including the program in agricultural production. More information is available at 217-265-5363 or on the web at psm.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we'll talk with Julia Shears about her book, A Thousand Lives. It takes a look at the people who died at Jonestown, the followers of the Reverend Jim Jones, and it's been a little over 30 years since those events. And what she is trying to do in her book is to really look at who these people were, examine their lives, why it was they followed Jim Jones, and what happened to them. And I think she really takes on the idea that this was a mass suicide and that somehow these people were irrational. And I think that she tries to make the argument that in many cases, this was not a mass suicide, it was a mass murder. More on that when she talks with us in hour number two. If you can check on our schedule, you can listen to past programs by going to our website, WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Siddhartha Deb. He teaches creative writing at the New School in New York City. He's authored two novels and has written for other publications, journalism for other publications, Boston Globe, Guardian, Harper's Magazine, The Nation, New Statesman. His book that we're talking about this morning is The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. Faber and Faber is the publisher. It's just recently come out. We do have someone waiting here patiently. We'll get right to them. And other people you'd like to be a part of the conversation, you can do that by calling us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here is a caller to bring in Urbana, line number one, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You mentioned Western consumerism. What other parallels can you draw from India's development to the so-called first world? And are these parallels good, bad, or neutral compared to India? Thank you.
All right.
I'm not sure I understood completely, but I think I'll riff off on that. Basically, you know, I'm not actually a great ascetic. But I do think there's been a kind of sort of, you know, incredible valorization of hyper-consumerism in India about, you know, weddings of people spend millions of dollars. There's a kind of thing that this is good, this is great. I think there are many more interesting things we can learn from the West, and we have been, including, you know, the use of language, the use of culture. I think people talk to each other, and I think, you know, that's been happening. I think to fixate on a very particular kind of, you know, a kind of market consumerism and an idea of the majority of Indians as just consumers is deeply problematic because it sidesteps these other things we need to think about, including equality, the idea of citizenship, the idea of rights. And it's all there, but it's kind of been pushed down almost into the underground by the last 15, 20 years. And, you know, so I think that's where the problem is with sort of fixating completely on consumerism or on the fact that India has sort of the second highest growth rate, its economy has the second highest growth rate in the world.
All right. Again, well, I hope that gets at the question. Others are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I do actually also want to ask you about this other photo that's on the UK version of the book, and this is, it's also a portrait, and it looks kind of like a snapshot, as if something that might be taken on holiday, and it's a full-length portrait of a woman. She's wearing a sari, a hot pink sari, so the color is like really intense. She's wearing these great big sunglasses, and she is standing in front of a significant landmark in Mumbai. It's a thing that's called the Gateway of India, and it's this big, imposing, castle-like looking structure. And as I understand it, back in the day, if you arrived by boat, that it would be the very first thing that you would see.
Absolutely.
And so she's standing square in front of this as if her husband maybe had said, okay, dear, go over there, stand there, and I'll take your picture. And she's looking very posed, and you really can't see a lot of her face, though, because she's wearing these great big sunglasses. Just tell me about that picture.
Well, again, I mean, it's somebody who's sort of in a landmark, somebody who's probably like visiting Bombay or Mumbai, as it's called these days. So it's a landmark. And in a way, you know, it's probably a family holiday. So it's perfectly, and she's dressed up, and she's got lovely sunglasses and a very nice sari. And she seems quite well-to-do, you know, just from the handbag. So, again, this is, to me, you know, absolutely, it's like a fine, you know, this is fine. In terms of the landmark, of course, you know, it shows the complex sort of sense of the past. It was built by the British in India to celebrate the jewel in their crown, which was the Indian Empire. And the British interlude in India, and it was a very long interlude, was a tremendously destructive one. That's the other thing where attitudes have changed among the rich and the middle class in the last 15, 20 years. There's been this somewhat, oh no, you know, maybe they were not so bad. Because in a way, sometimes it seems to me what we've started doing is we've become colonizers of our own country. And if you look at the kind of people who are suffering deeply in India, the poor, the tribals, the so-called lower castes, minorities, if you see how Indian, sometimes Indian companies, sometimes foreign companies in alliances with Indian companies go into these mineral-rich tribal areas, sort of, you know, ringed by, supported by paramilitary units to extract natural resources. And, you know, with the tribal, sort of the people who've lived there for thousands of years being displaced, herded into camps, or when you build the big dam, Narmada, you know, again, people being displaced. It's like... we've become these sort of we've become the British in, or in, and I don't mean the contemporary British. I mean the sort of we've become the colonial people, and that's what I think of when I look at the past. When I look at the gateway of India, which is not to say that I kind of want an erasure of the past. I mean, I have to. I hasten to add, I don't want that to be demolished or something. I want it to remain. It's a part of our history, and you know our. The British period is a part of a history, but I want us to learn from what was wrong about it, and perhaps if there were a few things that were right about it, I would like us to learn. And that kind of assessment seems to be missing, again, at the very top. There's this deep desire to catch up with the West, and the West is almost, as I said, it's a kind of Reagan America. This is one of the things people talk about. People talk about trickle-down theory. People, and we are again talking about the elite. People talk about this phrase from Ayn Rand, you know, who's this sort of kind of right-wing thinker. People use the phrase enlightened self-interest, how altruism is bad. It's bad to care about poor people because that all road leads to totalitarianism. And so the best thing you can do is just, you know, have this sort of enlightened self-interest and get richer and richer, and the rest will take care of itself. Or if people fall behind, well, it's too bad. They deserve it in some way. They didn't work hard enough. So these are all the things that I think of when I look at these covers.
Yeah, Grant. Okay, well, we have some other callers here. We'll go to the next here in Champaign County where we are. This is line one. Hello?
Hi. You talked about being from the Northeast, you just mentioned the tribal reason and the fights that are going on pretty much unreported. Mm-hmm. I assume the damned are the poor and the beautiful are the rich. Maybe you're inverting things, but I've heard you talk about the portraits you've done of the oligarchs, but how did you actually endeavor to, you know, summon this untold story to us about what's going on with the dam battles and the mass movements? What I know about it is from two women from India, Arundhati Roy, who apparently is in New York because
absolutely.
She spoke to the Occupy movement
yes.
yesterday.
Yes.
And also Vandana Shiva,
yes.
who's been very involved in
yes.
these grassroots movements that we don't hear about. But so yes. I wanted you to talk about how you approach that. I don't know how you feel about you know, traveling with the comrades. She's subject to some draconian laws that have actually jailed a fellow. I think he's been released for supposedly consorting with the Maoists or something. I don't know. There's a lot there.
Yes. Thank you. That's a great question. Both Arundhati Roy and Vandana Shiva are women. Are people I admire deeply. And you know, let that be on the record. And, you know, I was, when Arundhati's book, Broken Republic, came out in the UK earlier this summer, we were together, actually, on many radio shows. We may have nuances of difference, but broadly, we agree, and I think she's very, very courageous. I think she has a kind of courage that I don't possess, for instance. She was sort of, you know, they had talked about bringing sedition charges against her because she's been very, very vocal about the Indian occupation in Kashmir, for instance, where of the most recent story seems to be that, you know, some 6,000 bodies have been uncovered in mass graves. Again, things you do not hear about in the Western media. I grew up in the northeastern part of the country where there has been, you know, where there have been sort of insurgency movements, sometimes violent insurgency movements against the, you know, against India, but also rather draconian laws, the most draconian being something called the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which has been imposed in a state called Manipur, which I write about in my book, actually, which is a state I'm very fond of, deeply fond of. And it's basically almost like martial law. It allows any army officer to shoot, to kill under suspicion, and you can't bring them to trial in a civil court. They can only be tried by a military tribunal. Now, that law has been in place in Manipur. It's been in place in Kashmir, although there's some talk of lifting it. And then in central India, which is a hugely mineral-rich region, a lot of natural resources, and which is also primarily tribal, it seems to be a war zone, basically, between a kind of civil war, in some ways, a low-grade civil war with the Maoists on one side, and they are kind of with the tribals, and then you have paramilitary army units on the other side. So I find this deeply disturbing. But at the same time, I think what I will have to say in terms of my book, I'll give you an example, actually, a very specific story. I went to a village in southern India in the state of Andhra Pradesh, and somebody was showing me around, and this village was surrounded by industries, and they took me to this sort of, you know, water tank. And when I got near the water tank, I couldn't breathe because it was just reeking of chemical effluents that had been poured in from these factories. I was like maybe, you know, 100 feet, and I said, I can't go any further because my eyes are burning. And then I came back, and the villagers said, look, we can't grow anything on our land anymore because the ground is just poisoned, basically. And then these villagers were not beaten down villagers. They were quite assertive. They had education. They were not completely poor. They were capable of organizing. And they said, you know, we've tried everything that the laws of the country tell us we can try. They said, we petitioned the courts. We've organized. And what has happened is our case got thrown out of court. Our leader was bought off. We were beaten up by the police. They said, we've tried everything. And at the end of the day, what we have is we have a village, and we have the option to sell off the land to the factories, but we don't want to sell off the land. We want to keep farming because we are happy doing this. We've been doing this for centuries. We've been living here for 500 years, some of us, our families. We don't want to move. We don't want to become landlords in some urban slum. And they said, but we've tried every mode of protest, and it hasn't worked. And then they started laughing, and they said, you know, if the Maoists came here, they would find support among us. So I think there's a great deal of discontent. There is a great range of popular movements in India, and the Maoists are the sort of the underground armed warfare one end of it. But there are also large civil disobedience movements. There's been these huge strikes been happening at this factory that's partly owned by Maruti Suzuki. It's an Indo-Japanese venture. It's a car, it's an automobile factory. These workers have been on strike, and they've been beaten up. So there's a lot of popular discontent and protest movements around the country. And that's what Indian democracy is, actually. And I think that's what gives me hope. And I think often the elites don't like that. They wish it would be, you could, you know, when they refer to China, they refer to the authoritarian aspect of, you know, as something that they like and they wish they could emulate, you know, if they could just, you know, get rid of all these protests. But there are protests happening all over the country, and I don't think it's going to go away.
Mm. All right. To Belgium for another caller here. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I hope Mr. Inge will allow me a few moments to tell a little tale that I think you'll find very, very interesting. In the very recent past, last couple of years, I have been immersed in Indian culture because of fate. And I'm going to tell a story about a gentleman. It's not his real name. I'm going to call him J. Paul. And I don't think he might want me to relay it, but maybe he would. Anyway, the story is he's from Hyderabad, which is down near Bangalore, Bangaloo, whichever way you want to call it. And his father was a lawyer and got him into schools, and he became a physician at the expense of the Indian government. They paid for his education back in the late 60s, early 70s. And he realized that if he was going to make any money, he'd have to go to the United States. Well, the Indian nation said, no, we don't want you to leave. After we made you a physician, we want you to stay here. Well, he went to Sri Lanka or Ceylon, whatever you want to call it, and immigrated to the United States. Became a successful individual, became wealthy, doing well, and he feels guilty, and he wants to give money back to India to help the poor and stuff because he's done very well. And so he starts helping along with some of his other physicians that he knows are in the same situation. And then he comes to the realization that he can't move back to India. And I said, well, why can't you move back to India? Because, well, if I move back to India, I'm going to become a poor man because my friends who stayed in Hyderabad have done very, very well and to a much greater extent than I did in the United States. I mean, it's so strange that you would leave a poor country, become wealthy, but the people who stayed there and were in positions of power became far more wealthy than you did. And now, even though you want to give back and go back, you can't really afford to. How would you like to comment about that?
I don't know. I feel like that's like, it's a really interesting story. But, you know, I mean, I find like, I don't know. I'm not so. I feel like maybe the people who stayed back, who got rich, I'm sure they were a very small minority who got wealthy. I mean, what is being rich and being, I mean, not being able to afford to go back mean? I mean, it's still. I don't really understand that because I mean, it's a question of one's needs, and in a way. If you've grown up in the United States, if you've moved to the U.S. and you've made some money, you should be able to have a perfectly decent, comfortable life when you go back to India. You might not be able to have a mansion, but I mean, I think it's fine for people to compare, you know, who's making more money, but it's not entirely relevant to the larger discussion about the country, because we are talking about a country where. You know, 40% of children under the age of 5 suffer from malnutrition. It's the greatest, you know, it has 43.5%. In fact, I'm looking at a table of underweight children. You know, we are talking about these things. So I'm not saying that, you know, it's not relevant, the discussions that these people are having, but maybe it doesn't really matter in the long run if you are doing. You know, if you have a middle class life, I think you're doing quite well actually, and it doesn't matter if other people, whether they're in India or whether they're in America, have much more money than you do.
I need to jump in here. I want to thank the caller. We just have a couple of minutes left, and you know, in the outset of the interview, I talked about the fact that what you're trying to do is by looking at a few individuals, mm-hmm. saying something larger about India, different places, different. Socioeconomic levels. A lot of the book really is devoted to trying to take a look at the lives of people who are on the bottom ends of the ladder, who are trying to haul themselves up. And I guess I just would like you to talk a little bit about Esther, just because it seems like this is the woman who's profiled in the last chapter and is indeed a compelling character. And it seems like a lot of the reviewers of the book have pointed to that as being what they thought was maybe one of the most compelling stories. A woman who actually grew up in, I think, in the part of India where you did.
Yes.
It works in Delhi in an upscale hotel and restaurant, but then has to commute back to an apartment which she shares with two of her sisters. So here is someone who is really who works in the world of the affluent, but lives in a different world. What about her captured your imagination?
She's a very moving. I mean, I'm very proud of that chapter. Basically, I really wanted to give some kind of. You know, you see young women like this all over the big cities: Hyderabad, Bangalore, Delhi, Bombay.
You see people, you know, you see them in the nice cafes, the new hotels and restaurants that have cropped up. But nobody really talks about them in any detail. So I'm particularly proud that, you know, I managed to find one of them and sort of, you know, allow her this chance to sort of express herself. She's tremendously hardworking. And again, it's a complex picture. In a way, when she has mobility, she has come from Manipur. She's traveled thousands of miles. She works in this very, very fancy restaurant. But, and so, you know, she's proud. I mean, she actually helps support her younger siblings and, you know, with her salary. And she has seen, you know, she's seen the big city. And, you know, she's moved up. But it's not the sort of unambiguous tale of wonderful upward mobility. There were many points when she talked about, she said, I wish I could have my mother's life. Her mother was just a school teacher in the little provincial town who had never left. And I said, why do you want to have your mother's life? Because you were excited by coming to the big city. And she said, but because I feel like this has no future, I can only keep doing this as long as I'm young, this sort of service job. There's no stability. Whereas if I were to become a school teacher like my mother, I could keep doing it. And I think that's, Esther is one of the people I've stayed in touch with a little bit. That's not her real name. She's not in that job anymore. She quit the restaurant job. And she said, you know, she and a lot of her friends just walked out because the hours were too long. The money wasn't bad, but just the hours were too long. When I interviewed her, she would work for 11, 12 hours a day. You can't keep doing that for 20, 30 years. So there's a lot of that kind of exploitation. And I'm proud, you know, Esther's story brings out the nuances, both the opportunities, but also the incredible limitations, in some sense, the lack of a future.
Yeah. Just real quick, there's obviously two big audiences for the book. One would be people who know India and the other people who don't, or at least what they know of India is what they see in popular media. For them, what idea would you like to get across?
Well, do I have a single idea? Well, it's a complex country, and maybe everything you've been hearing about in the last 15, 20 years isn't exactly true, and that there are many more shades to this country than just the shopping malls or the IT centers. That it's a little universe in itself, and that there's much more variety and diversity and inequality than we've been told. What we've got is a kind of two-dimensional India. It's much more complex than that.
All right. Siddhartha Deb is our guest. He teaches creative writing at the New School in New York and is the author of The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. It is published by Faber and Faber, just out recently. Siddhartha Deb, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, thank you so much for inviting me.
We're at a point here when we have to take a break, as we usually do, in the second hour of the show. Our guest will be journalist Julia Shears. We'll be talking about her newly published book, 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. It tells the story of what happened there at Jonestown a little over 30 years ago and tries to profile the lives of the people who followed Jim Jones there and why it was they did that. So that'll be in hour number two. First, though, as we usually do at this point, we'll be taking a break so we can bring you an update on the markets and some news from National Public Radio, so please stay tuned.